The bigger problem for Jeter was discovering what Rodriguez was like as a teammate. Jeter was already chagrined to see the camaraderie of the championship teams disintegrating around him ever since O'Neill, Brocious, Martinez, and Knobloch left after the 2001 World Series. He could look around the clubhouse in 2004 and 2005 and see random veterans who just seemed to be passing through, people such as Kevin Brown, Kenny Lofton, Randy Johnson, and Tony Womack. Rodriguez, with his hyper-self-awareness, was the most visible and controversial symbol of the Yankees moving further away from what Jeter knew as the definition of championship teams. Jeter and Rodriguez were wired way too differently, saw very different versions of what it took to win, for the Yankees to recapture that togetherness of the championship years. "Their motivations are completely different," Messina said. "It will always be that way. I mean, there's nothing wrong with either one of their motivations. It's just that it's not the same motivation. And I think that group that Derek learned to play with, O'Neill and Tino and those guys, the motivation was all the same. They knew they weren't the greatest players in the league, but they knew if they did their job as a group, they could win. Derek's not the greatest player in the league, even in his best years. But he knows how to win. He knows how to get the hit in the big spot. He knows what it takes. He knows how to run the bases. And he's got pedigree now. And it doesn't matter to him what the consequences of failure might be. There's no fear of that. Alex may end up calling attention to himself, but he's not loud about it. Alex has this motivation to be the best player in the game. When all is said and done, he wants to be the best player ever. That's his motivation in this. That's fine. That's good. Everybody needs a motivation, whatever it is." The dynamic between Jeter and Rodriguez never was an open war that sent collateral damage flying about the rest of the clubhouse. Indeed, they operated more along the lines of a cold truce. But everybody in the clubhouse could feel the frost emanating from the Jeter-Rodriguez dynamic. "I don't think it's helped the team," Borzello said. "That team is a machine, though. It's resilient. You deal with so much there that most things don't faze you. You come in, do your thing. There are enough guys who do get along well that I don't think anyone is fazed by it. I don't think other players care that those two got along. It was never arguing or shouting. It was just sort of a cold shoulder. It doesn't help. You would rather that the stars are in the same place, pulling together, but I don't think it affected the other players. It just affected the feel in the clubhouse. And it separates the team off the field because Alex is going to go one way with a group of guys, Derek is going to go another way with a group of guys, and it's never going to be a group of 10 or 12 or 15 guys together." Said Boa about the relationship between Jeter and Rodriguez. "I think it's workable, but it is what it is. I saw the article they're all talking about, and obviously Derek took it real personal. And if Alex could do it over again, he'd probably redo it. He wouldn't say that. I think Jeet has gradually forgiven him a little bit, but I don't think they're ever going to be, as they say, buddies." The bottom line was that Jeter and Rodriguez were vastly different people. Jeter did not care too much about his statistics and place in history. Rodriguez was consumed not only about his status in that regard, but all things baseball. "He's a fan of baseball first, and he happens to be a great player," Borzello said. "But he's a baseball fan. Whether he ever made it in baseball, he would be watching baseball all day long if he could. I'm telling you, we'd go from Yankee Stadium after the last out, get in the car, talk about the game, go to his house, and watch the West Coast games on the baseball package. I remember him going to Derek Jeter's house once, me and him. He was going to get a haircut. Jeter had someone who cut hair at his house, so we went over there, and we sit down, and Alex turns on the TV, waiting for the guy. And Jeter's walking around, and Alex goes, 'Where's the baseball package? Jeet, what channel is the baseball package on?' And Jeter goes, 'I don't have that stuff.' And Alex goes, 'How come you don't have the baseball package?' He couldn't believe it, like, 'What else do you do?' So it was just so funny because Derek will never watch a baseball game other than the one he's playing in. They're just complete opposites. I remember Alex's reaction to it was like, 'How is that possible?'" The third year of Jeter and Rodriguez living under the same clubhouse roof was the worst. "I could feel the tension," Boa said, "and never more so than on the afternoon of August 17, 2006, for a game at Yankee Stadium against Baltimore. The Orioles hammered the Yankees that day, 12-2, dropping the Yankees' first-place lead over the Red Sox to 1.5 games, on the eve of an enormously important 5-game series in Boston. In a signature moment, easily the worst moment of the blowout defeat to Baltimore, neither Rodriguez nor Jeter attempted to catch a pop-up between the two of them on the left side of the infield. When the ball plopped to the infield dirt, neither bothered to immediately retrieve it. Instead, in silence, they sort of turned their backs to one another, each one of them as if in protest for not just letting the ball drop without an attempt to catch it, but for adhering to a completely different doctrine on what it took to win. They seemed at that moment, with a baseball landing between them, to have absolutely nothing in common. Torrey kept the clubhouse door closed after that game to air out his team, while specifically calling out Jeter and Rodriguez. "I don't know who wants to catch that thing," Torrey said, "but somebody has to catch the son of a bitch. It looks horseshit. It looks like you don't care. I don't know whose fault it was, and I don't care. The only thing I know is that it can't drop, so you guys better figure it out. Now, we all have two ways to go from here, going up to Boston. If you take this up there, the way you just played, you're in trouble. Basically, you better leave this shit here. This was shitty. There's no excuse for it. We stunk. Now let's see what we're made of." The Yankees would sweep all 5 games from Boston in Fenway Park, essentially salting away another division title. After the game with the pop-up debacle, Cashman consulted with Torrey on not only that play, but also the Jeter-Rodriguez dynamic. Cash totally blamed Jeter on the basis of the shortstop having priority on a pop-up, Torrey said. "There were times I had to defend Jeter. Cash went over backwards sometimes, thinking the captain should be more proactive than what Jeter wanted to be in the relationship with Alex. I know I'm a little partial to Derek, so you have to take it into consideration. Plus, he's hurt, and he still plays. He never looks for anything more than going out and playing. I'm not saying he does things 100% of the time that he should do, but as far as competing, he's always there for you." Cashman was already miffed with Torrey and Jeter for not throwing enough public support toward Rodriguez during a 3-month slump that summer, in which fans at Yankee Stadium booed the third baseman with gusto. Rodriguez hit .257 over the slump and played awful defense, kicking ground balls and bouncing throws. The New York newspapers reflected his poor play with headlines such as, "Do you hate this man? Personal hell for Alex is getting worse by the day. E-Rod. K-Rod. Alex gets a hit." Cashman looked to Torrey and Jeter to help get Yankee fans off Rodriguez's back. He told Torrey, "You've got to tell Derek he has to come out and support Alex and tell the fans to leave him alone." "I can't do that," Torrey said. "Because if you ask Jeter to do that and he starts doing it, then people will say, 'Why didn't he do that last year?' I can't do that. He's a teammate. He and Alex know each other. It's not like he needs to get to know this guy or he's misreading him. They've been together long before we met them." Torrey wasn't going to ask Jeter to tell the fans to ease up on Rodriguez. He wasn't going to ask Jeter to do something he didn't want to do anyway. "My job as a player is not to tell the fans what to do," Jeter said then. "My job is not to tell the media what to write about. They're going to do what they want. They should just let it go. How many times can you ask the same questions?" Jeter was asked if he had seen anyone criticized as much as Rodriguez. "Nobby," he said, referring to error-prone former second baseman Chuck Knobloch. "Clemens for a whole year. Tino. Has A-Rod's treatment been worse?" "I don't know," he said. "I don't think about that. I'm just concerned with doing what we can to win. That's it. I don't worry about that other stuff." Shortly before the pop-up episode, Rodriguez agreed to meet with Reggie Jackson over dinner. Jackson was concerned that Rodriguez was tone-deaf to what was happening in his own clubhouse. Jackson knew that players were trying to help Rodriguez to get on track, whether it was at the plate or fitting into the team structure, but that Rodriguez wasn't getting the message because he was convinced that everything was perfectly fine. Jackson began by telling Rodriguez he knew what it was like to struggle as a Yankee, and knew it to be much worse than what Rodriguez had known. Jackson said teammates would leave notes in the clothes in his locker telling him they didn't want him on the team. He told Rodriguez that manager Billy Martin so beat it into his head that he was a bad defensive player that on the night he famously hit 3 home runs in the 1977 World Series, Jackson played a routine double to right field into a triple out of sheer passivity caused by fear he'd screw it up. Jackson also relayed a story that he once was mired in such an embarrassing, horrific streak of strikeouts that when he stepped into the batter's box, he said to Tigers catcher Lance Parrish, "Tell me what's coming and I promise I'll take a turn right back into the dugout no matter where I hit it. I just want to look like a pro a little bit." Parrish replied, "Fuck you." Jackson, to his immense satisfaction, managed to ground out. Reggie wanted A-Rod to know he really didn't have it that bad. Jackson later told this parable to make a point about how Rodriguez refused to admit he was struggling or to accept the advice of teammates. A man is trapped in his house as floodwaters rise. Twice he refuses help, once from rescuers in a boat, and then, when the man seeks refuge on his roof, from rescuers in a helicopter. "No thanks, I've got faith," the man said each time. The next thing he knows, the man is face to face with God in heaven. "But I put my faith in you," the man cried. "Yes," God replied, "and I answered your faith and tried to help you twice." The Yankees soon reached the point of frustration in their effort to help Rodriguez. Jason Giambi came to Torrey and said, "Skip, it's time to stop coddling him." Recalling that conversation, Torrey said, "What Jason said made me realize that I had to go at it a different way. When the rest of the team starts noticing things, you have to get this fixed. That's my job. I like to give individuals what I believe is the room they need, but when I sense that other people are affected, team-wise, I have to find a solution to it and take an approach that is a little more serious." Torrey asked Rodriguez to sit down with him in his office in the visiting clubhouse in Seattle. He wanted to snap Rodriguez from this false world he lived in, to have Rodriguez recognize what everybody else in the room did, that he was struggling and needed help. "This is all about honesty," Torrey told Rodriguez, "and it's not about anything else but you. You can't pretend everything is okay when it's not. You have to face the reality that you're going through a tough time and then work from there." That night, batting as a pinch hitter, Rodriguez struck out to end the game. He pounded the dugout railing with his bat on his way back to the dugout, walked up the runway and into the clubhouse, and picked up a folding chair and threw it. The trouble for Rodriguez as a Yankee was that everything he did, and especially everything that he didn't do, such as hitting in the clutch, winning a championship, or staying out of the tawdry gossip items, was compared and contrasted to Jeter, the Yankee template. Rodriguez, though recognized as the more talented player and certainly the far better slugger, could not win the comparison. With the Yankees under Torrey, for instance, Jeter outhit Rodriguez with runners in scoring position, 311 to 306, outhit him with runners in scoring position with two outs, 316 to 274, outhit him in the postseason, 309 to 245, and outhit him overall, 317 to 306. Cashman, who had traded for Rodriguez and understood the value of his enormous production at bat, wanted to believe in Rodriguez, which meant the blame would go to Jeter if a pop-up fell between them or if the fans would not stop booing A-Rod. Torrey, on the other hand, trusted Jeter like a son and never did get the same sense of reliability from Rodriguez. "My relationship with Derek has been great," Torrey said. "Whatever I've asked him, he's been about as reliable as you can get. With Alex? When I'm having my annual charitable dinner for the Safe at Home Foundation, I only invite a few players, guys who live around New York. Because it's in the off-season, and I don't want guys to feel like they have to fly in, except when we honored the 1996 or 1998 team. So Alex said to me, 'Skip, why don't you invite me to your dinner?' I said, 'Alex, your wife is pregnant. I don't want to invite you if it means taking you away from her and from home. You're certainly welcome to come. We'd love to have you.' He said, 'I'll be there.' He canceled the day before, based on his wife being due so soon. It didn't surprise me." 9. Marching to Different Drum Beats. Joe Torre called Bernie Williams and Kenny Lofton into his office one day in the Yankees' 2004 spring training camp and closed the door. The two veterans, both competing for the center field job, sat in upholstered chairs across from Torrey, with the manager's desk between them and Torrey. "Guys," Torrey said, "we've got a dilemma here. The Yankees had signed Lofton that winter to a 2-year, $6.2 million deal, essentially because they didn't trust Williams anymore to be their everyday center fielder. Williams had batted .263 in a season in which he had missed 42 games after knee surgery. The Yankees' front office suspected that an aging Williams should be transitioned to life as a designated hitter, an idea Torrey wasn't ready to endorse completely. The Yankees had just watched Juan Pierre and Luis Castillo help the Marlins beat them in the 2003 World Series by giving Florida speed at the top of the lineup, and Lofton was the Yankees' attempt at a copycat move. It was a poor attempt. The signing was fraught with misguided thinking. For one, Lofton, then 36, was older than Williams, 35, and there was no evidence that he was an upgrade on Williams. Even in an injury-shortened season, Williams hit more home runs, drove in more runs, and posted a better on-base percentage in 2003 than Lofton. Moreover, Lofton had turned into a baseball transient, unable to stay rooted with any team in the decline of his career, and unwilling to concede he was no longer an everyday player. In 27 months, he was the property of 6 teams, moving from the Indians to the White Sox to the Giants to the Pirates to the Cubs to the Yankees. Lofton tried to be somewhat diplomatic and obligatory on a conference call with reporters to announce his signing. "If they want me to park cars," he said, "I'll do that." But Lofton wasn't about to start doing any grunt work in his baseball career. He thought of himself as a proud all-star caliber center fielder, and nothing else short of that. When Lofton was asked on the conference call about the possibility of replacing Williams, a Yankee icon in center field, he replied, "They said they want me to play center field. I am a center fielder, and they know that." That was true enough, but was Lofton a better center fielder than Williams? Maybe, but maybe not. What was true was that the Yankees had signed an older player with a checkered reputation who was not clearly better than Williams. Before the signing was announced, Torrey called up Williams and told him, "We're getting Kenny Lofton. That doesn't mean anything is set for center field. We're going to start the season with the best center fielder, whoever that is." It was a rotten scenario, sure to displease both of them. Lofton, who never had accepted being a role player in his career, thought he was being signed to play center field, when actually Torrey considered him to be coming to camp to compete for the job. Williams, the proud link to 6 pennant-winning teams, was stripped of his hold of the center field job he had held for 10 seasons, and forced to compete not with an up-and-coming prospect with young legs, but with an older player. But there was another problem, a corrosive one to the bifurcated center field scenario, a problem that revealed itself in the spring training meeting in Torrey's office. Every team is asked in spring training to submit to Major League Baseball the names that will be placed on the All-Star Game ballot. Each team is permitted to list 3 outfielders. The Yankees had Gary Sheffield, whom they had signed that winter as a free agent, established in right field, and Hideki Matsui, established in left field. No problem there. Center field, though, was an open competition between Williams and Lofton, and baseball officials needed an answer before that competition was to be decided. General Manager Brian Cashman asked Torrey, "Who shall we use in center field on the ballot?" Said Torrey, "We'll call them both in and work it out." So Torrey brought Williams and Lofton into his office to settle what he thought was a minor procedural issue. If either one played very well in the first half of the season, they would be selected to the All-Star game anyway, whether they were listed on the official fan ballot or not. "We've got to put an All-Star ballot together," Torrey told Williams and Lofton. "You've both been around long enough. You know, if you have a good year, you get voted or picked. But right now it's just about being on the ballot, and we have to make a decision." Lofton had yet to play a game for the Yankees. Williams was a franchise star and a Torrey favorite. Yet the manager would not favor one over the other. "Here's what I'm going to do," Torrey told them. "You're both all-stars. You've both done it before. I'm going to put your names into a hat. Whoever comes out of the hat is the guy we put on the ballot." Williams shrugged nonchalantly as if to say, "Whatever, fine." Lofton rolled his eyes and pouted. Torrey put 2 folded pieces of paper into his hat and started shaking the hat to mix them up. Suddenly, one of the folded pieces of paper jumped out of the hat and fell to the floor. "Let's use that one," Lofton said. "All right," Torrey said, "fine." Torrey picked up the piece of paper and unfolded it. He showed it to the 2 center fielders. Bernie Williams. Lofton dropped his head and shook it in anger. Torrey was taken aback by Lofton's reaction. I thought, what does that mean? Torrey said. He's probably not going to play enough to make the All-Star team, so what the hell's the difference anyway? Watching Lofton's reaction made Torrey think he could leave nothing open to interpretation about this little game of chance. He reached into his hat and pulled out the folded piece of paper that said Kenny Lofton and showed it to him. I had to open it up to show him that he was on the other one to make sure he didn't think there were two Bernies, Torrey said. That was a big deal to him, being on the All-Star ballot. It's too bad. And I had a taste of that kind of thinking on All-Star teams. It was always interesting when you watched all those guys from Cleveland when they came to All-Star games. They were so undisciplined. Cologne, Manny, Lofton, Bell. They were just marching to their own drummer. That was the real problem. The Yankees no longer had one drum beat. It was obvious before the Yankees played a game in the 2004 season that the workmanlike, egoless culture of the championship Yankee teams was irretrievably gone. Sure, the Yankees began to change when they said goodbye to Paul O'Neill, Scott Brosius, Tino Martinez, and Chuck Knobloch after the 2001 World Series. But in 2003, they had successfully transitioned into a pitching-dominant team, clearly the best team in baseball until the Marlins, a 91-win wild-card team, happened to throw some hot pitchers at them in October. The front office panic after that 2003 World Series did more to send the Yankees into a downward spiral, especially when it came to building a roster with team-centric grinders, than anything that happened after the 2001 World Series. Not long after the 2003 World Series, Torrey gave Brian Cashman a word of advice on Weaver. I remember telling Cash, you've got to get rid of this guy because emotionally he can't handle it. Trying to come back from that, Torrey said. It's not like Eckersley giving up the home run to Kirk Gibson or Mariano giving up the home run to Sandy Alomar. This guy wasn't emotionally equipped to deal with that, especially in New York. I had become more comfortable with his pitching, like what he did earlier in that game, than I was earlier. But I couldn't sell it. There was just too much stuff that had happened. Weaver would never throw another pitch for the Yankees. With a trade that winter, the Yankees turned Weaver into Kevin Brown, one pitcher who struggled with New York for another. Only older. In that one off-season, the Yankees brought in Lofton, the surly antisocial Kevin Brown, the infamously moody Sheffield, and the needy status-seeking Alex Rodriguez. In addition, the team shipped off its two best young hitters, Nick Johnson and Juan Rivera, to obtain pitcher Javier Vasquez, who came from Montreal wholly unprepared for pitching under the weight of expectations in New York. Of course, they still had Jason Giambi, the guy with his own personal trainer at his beck and call, and who had removed himself from the starting lineup in the previous World Series and then been summoned to appear in front of the grand jury investigating the Balco scandal. The Yankees were less of a team than ever before in the Torrey years and more a collection of individual stars. You're mixing together people from all different teams, pitcher Mike Messina said. You're not going to get that precise, perfect blend with every group of players you put in uniform. And when you do find that perfect mix, you've got to hang on to it. It hasn't been the same mix, and it's nobody's fault. I don't blame any one player or any group of players for anything. It's just different. When asked how long the Yankees were able to maintain the right blend of players who kept to the same mindset, Messina said, until 03. Until probably even 03. Then Andy left after 03, and Roger left, and Boomer left. So when 04 rolled around, it was really different. We had very different personalities.